No, I just to kind of
see your song.
It's very probably.
I don't remember if I asked you this. Did you go surfing?
Surfing?
Yeah.
Kayak surfing. That's also fun. And you don't have to have such a feeling for balance, right? We capsized several times.
Not bad.
So, feeling for balance helps.
No, we just rented kayaks and we went into the surf and
it was
very, 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 but still it's fun. But then the guy who rented it from was very angry. We're not supposed to do that with the rented kayak.
Those are not welcome there anymore. What do people do? Just paddle along the shore for a little
bit? Yeah, you can sort of can paddle under the pier, or can paddle to this buoy where you have got the sea lions, can disturb the rest, or just in the harbor a little bit.
So is that in the downtown Santa Barbara or
here? Yes, the harbor. Second speaker is also there, so.
The reason is this.
That was Barbara's rush.
So we should be second.
The peak was yesterday. It's all the whole body reaction.
Yes,
there
are all sorts of
indications for that. You didn't get the quarter time
clock, so I think this
is great.
So you got
chops?
No. But you have some...
some stuff to put on, but it's got swollen eyes. Hopefully today it'll be better. These parts will make up and it's swollen. We all went through the same thing. I don't know why I didn't get it.
No, the dust was not exactly the same. It was only this sample body.
Yeah, the more sensitive. She's got a very sensitive skin.
Exactly. So it's very. So they say that even people who are not so sensitive, if just one contact, they have no problems. But it has too hot. It happens too often.
Yeah. Also, I was watching not catch it, but. She was just trying to bite me, but she didn't try to bite me.
I should only go to those places where you deserve to go into the brushes, otherwise.
Mary is definitely also been a path far away from any sort of plants that can come.
No, just I think if you have long trousers, it's not a
problem.
But my tick bite is getting red and
sort of. I'll let her know. This is encouraging. Makes my heart warm. But it's only one fraction of what we were thinking of doing to me if that cliff was not accessible. I had to go back.
You have a little bit of suggestion what could happen.
Yeah,
I think I would have made almost any cliff, I guess, because I felt.
You would have had to. Start climbing away from us. We grab all of you. You would be in a sacrifice in one of those big boulders.
You know. Any overhang.
One of those wedge stones, you know.
Yeah, so I think we can start. Like.
four.
Why did you do that?
Oh, you were not seeing it on your screen?
Yeah, I didn't see the screen, so.
How about that?
Okay, so with my talk, it's about the domain of emotion, and it's related to what people do at IBM, where they try to build new memory. My collaborators are ergonomist Masamisa Kayashi, also a student at Stanford, grad student, as well as Stuart Parkin, and Sasha Jarrah, who was visiting from Georgetown University and former Johnson Computer Series. So I will be talking about things which happen due to spin transfer, so two slides to remind you about spin transfer. And the basic idea is that if you have localized magnets represented by blue arrows and itinerary electrons with spins represented by red arrows, they go from one place to another. And if you have a non-uniform magnetization structure, and if you have at each point of contact interaction, just as an arrow, then as red arrow moves, it wants to follow the blue arrow and it rotates. And so there must be a torque acting on it. This torque back acts on something, either a magnetization, then it wants to rotate it, or sometimes it can walk and act on the lattice, then the whole thing wants to be rotated, but that's usually hard to observe. And that's the basic phenomenon. The phenomenon of transfer of spin, of course, was known for a very long time, and that's the famous experiment where people had a silly cylinder on the torsional pendulum, and they reversed the magnetization and observed how the cylinder started to rotate in 1903 or something. But in modern times, the attention was drawn to it again by Johnson Chesky and Lucrezier, and originally the Sanchevsky approach was to consider wires which were made mostly of normal non-magnetic metal but with magnetic pieces embedded into them, and there was a current going through, and this current led to an additional interaction between the magnetic pieces which was proportional to the current. So what Sanchevsky did, he considered two pieces and he wanted to calculate what is the extra torque proportional to current acting on the second piece, for example, and he derived a formula shown here. And then he also considered what happens to the piece upstream. He came to a very interesting conclusion that both of those pieces will start to rotate as shown by those blue arrows here, and they will rotate in the same direction. So this thing looked puzzling, and one of the ways to think about it is to think about continuous change in magnetization in one magnetic piece. That's assumed to have a spiral texture of magnetization shown by the blue arrows here. And the red arrow spin comes in, and then it goes through, and as it goes, it rotates counterclockwise inside. And therefore, there is a torque which acts clockwise on the blue arrows. And so all these blue arrows want to rotate as the blue dashed arrow shows. So here, it's a little bit easier to imagine how everything happens, but in fact, this structure is not much different from the other one, and that's why it goes, it's also easy to believe that they both rotate in the same direction. Now, people measured that experimentally several couple of years later, after he proposed it, or a little more.
Is it to understand the backflow on the one on the left, on the larger one, I guess?
They're
still connected, you say?
There is a backflow, so the electrons come from here. They
yeah, the
get
buzzer is this one, right?
Sorry?
Yeah, the buzzer is that one.
Then they reflect, go back, and that's why this guy also experiences something. So if the
spin is not reflection, then it wouldn't be anything.
There wouldn't be nothing. So you can arrange that there is something here, but very little here, for example. So if people started to study that, and the way to study it was simply to take the torque derived by Sanchevsky and then re-derived by many, many other groups in a better way. However, the shape, or sort of the general functional form is the same. You have this vector product of three vectors, and then there is a factor which has to be calculated. It depends a lot on what regime you are in, and there's a lot of
discussion in literature how to calculate it. But if you know it, then you simply take this torque and you introduce it into the Lambda-Lipschitz equation. There, this is Lambda-Lipschitz equation with the first usual term and the usual Hilbert dissipation term, and this is an extra term due to spin transfer. So then you can study what happens in this simple structures proposed by Franceschi. And what we find is that if you have, for example, a situation shown here, and you have two external parameters, magnetic field which you point along the wire and the current which you pass through the wire, then you can, in the space of these two parameters, draw a diagram. And this diagram shows which states are stable and which are unstable. So everywhere above the blue line, the parallel state is stable. And everywhere below the red line, the anti-parallel state is also stable. So what is important for this discussion is that there is a wedge here where both parallel and anti-parallel are stable, so you can switch between them. And what's also nice is that you can put B equal to zero and simply switch between them with the current. So that was also observed in now by many, many groups. But for technical applications, this means that you have a bistable regime and you can use it as a memory cell, so that's one bit. And magnetic random access memory is discussed for a while, but it consists of spin walls, which look exactly like this, and people want to switch them with magnetic field. If you want to have a lot of elements, you want to have a magnetic field which is individual for each element, so it's hard to do. There are very interesting schemes proposed. But if instead of a magnetic field which is hard to localize, you switch it with a current, then you have much less problems, so everyone puts it in his proposal to switch the M-run with the current. And again, that was also studied, but with M-run, the technical problems which are projected in physics are that if you build them, you have to be very precise so far. And because you have to be very precise, the cost of element per bit is not competitive with the other types of memory. However, there is another idea which at least superficially decreases the cost a lot. And that's the idea of domain wall memory. So suppose you build one unit which is actually a wire, and you put notches in the wire, and then you can create domain walls. The domain walls are shown by these blue blobs. Then the wire separates into different domains, and let's say you can either apply a magnetic field along the wire back and up and down, or you can pass a current through the wire, and each time you give it a pulse, all domain walls move one notch. And they like to stay where the notches are because their energy is smaller there, so they do not stop at random places, but rather near the notches. So if you can reliably organize that, then you can have a type of memory where you read out by, let's say, a tunnel contact, very small voltage applied here, and you move this as a stack memory with an external large pulses of current. The scheme shown here probably is the most dumb one, so it's simply to illustrate what was the idea. And however, the spin which people put on it is that they say, look, it's one cell, but it has, let's say, 30 domain walls here, so you have to divide the cost by this number. And if you divide it, then it becomes very competitive. So can we build the memory based on domain walls, or in physics terms, can we reliably move domain walls around? The idea of moving domain walls with a current is also an old one. It was proposed by Hilbert in 78, and Hilbert and Franceschi are these two major figures who proposed everything in the old times. The Hilbert papers are mostly published in Journal of Applied Physics, and it's very hard to read them. So after a while, someone comes, in this case, reads that and formalizes what he says, so that, you know, people who are not that don't have so much intuition can understand it. And so here is what you get if you include the action of the current, the same spin transfer, in the case when magnetization does not change abruptly between pieces of magnets, but changes continuously like in the main wall. So again, this is a Lambda-Lipschitz equation. The way it's written here is for a simplest case when polarization of itinerant electrons is 100%. So then you just have this one term here, and it's proportional to the current, and it's an additional torque. You can understand this equation also 100% spin polarization very nicely in the following form. You can write this first line as an equation which emphasizes conservation of angular momentum. So m is a unit vector along spin, it's angular momentum. Then you add the derivative of the angular momentum flux. And then you add the volume torques. So that's a conservation, but the angular momentum is not conserved because you have volume torques from external fields. And the formula for lambda is here. So it has the usual part due to spin stiffness, which you'll always have in lambda lichts, plus something j times n. So that's very easy. You have full polarization, so all electrons are in the same direction. So that's why the flux is easy to write, and that's exactly how you like it to be. Now, if the polarization is not 100%, then this is the same equation, which has an additional term with current. And this is called non-adiabatic term. It was proposed by people. There are papers which say that things are not as simple as that. But so far, let's stick with this term. The coefficient beta is supposed to be small, and it's proportional to the ratio of the wavelengths of electron lambda to the width of the domain wall. So normally this is a small number. But it will play an important role, nevertheless. Before we go further, it's an interesting exercise to show that this spin transfer term here is actually not much different from the spin transfer term which we had in discrete cases. They look different, but if you rewrite the derivative as a combination of two vector products, which is an identity, and then substitute the gradient for the difference of magnetizations of the first and the second piece, which is an actual substitution, then you'll see that it's exactly the same result. Okay. So now, on the previous slide, we had a formula which shows how to what should you solve. The equation you should solve, and if you solve it, you find the whole vector field m as a function of r and t, and that's your very accurate. You can say, well, it's not quantum or really microscopic, but it's a detailed description of your domain walls, and in particular, it can describe complicated domain walls like this vortex wall. And if you solve it, you will see what happens is a vortex wall moves. People do it on a computer so far, but they get the result which resembles a real experiment. However, you can try to do one more step of simplification. You can say, look, the main wall is just a point-like object if you look far away from your wire. So wouldn't it be nice if you could write an equation just for the position of the domain wall, which would somehow effectively summarize what the Lambda-Lichtz equation gives you. Of course, if you look at this, this is a real experimental picture obtained in this paper, and what they found, their claim is, or their result by their NPRL is, that they showed that if you start with this type of domain wall, which is a vortex wall here, and you pump the current, the wall moves, but it also changes its structure, and after a while, it becomes a transverse wall, shown here. So, in this case, it's obvious that it's not enough to have just the position of the wall. You also have to have some internal parameters which characterize the shape of the wall. However, the idea remains the same. Maybe if the wall is sufficiently rigid, doesn't change its shape in an arbitrary way, you can have a few parameters which depend on time, and you want to write equations for this parameter. In this respect, the transverse walls, which are shown here, are much better because they do not really change their shape, so you have fewer parameters than here, and in fact, you only have, again, the minimal number of parameters to describe it as a lumped object is 2. So the first is obvious, the position. Why do you need the second one? The second one is, I'll show what it is on the second slide, but it's an angle which shows how much the magnetization goes out of plane. Now, why is there two parameters, not just one? So normally, this is a picture of the wall, and normally, because when you have a film, the magnetization likes to be in the plane of the film, everything is in the plane of the film. But if you want to move the wall, it's inevitable that you develop an n-loop psi where the moments go out of the plane. And these two cartoons show, these two diagrams show how it happens. If you drive the wall with magnetic field, then you will have this term, B cross n. And so you have n dot, which is out of the plane shown in red here. If you drive the wall with a current, then you have n dot, which is proportional to the gradient of n. This lies in the plane, so it seems current should be very effective in doing something in the plane. However, you also have this term, and it also drives you out of the plane. So all in all, if you make an analysis, you find that you have to have the second angle. And then people derived equations along the two parameters, q and psi. So instead of the partial differential equations, which is Lambda-Lipschitz, you now have two coupled ordinary differential equations, very simple system. The equations without the current were derived in the 70s when people were thinking about bubble domain memory. The current was added in several papers recently published. So in here, what enters this equation? So first of all, there is this term which shows how much the system doesn't like to go out of the plane. So k perp is an anisotropy constant which wants to have an easy plane. Now, the external is either your magnetic field which you apply externally or the pinning potential, and current is your current, m is, roughly speaking, the number of spins inside the domain wall. So what you see is that really, if you want to push something, the external potential is not in the equation, one step back, alpha is Hilbert damping, which is very small, so these two terms are small corrections. The external potential which you apply, which wants to push something, actually acts more on psi than on q. The current, on the other hand, acts more on q. Beta, it also is here, but beta is small. So we will rewrite this equation in dimensionless form. Again, red f is your external pinning or magnetic field. Blue current is the current. And it comes in a ratio of I over IC, where IC is a material parameter, can be estimated to be rather large. Okay. So the current quanta derived the system. And they studied what happens if you don't have external magnetic field, but you just want to drive the domain wall with the current. And here's what they found, that if you are below IC, the wall moves with a very small velocity, which is proportional to the small coefficient beta. And then when you cross IC, then the velocity goes up. So their conclusion was that, yes, you will move the walls, but interesting things happen at large currents. Now, so the first part will be to show that there are also some interesting things at low currents. So these are the same equations, and the point is that they are nonlinear, so you have this sine to psi. And they have two interesting regimes, which are very different. The first regime is when you can find solutions where psi is constant. And in this case, psi is constant, and the main wall moves with a constant velocity, and you can calculate this velocity. And the other regime is when there are no solutions, when this is the psi, when psi is constant. It happens if either your current is large or your f is large. So in this case, psi grows and oscillates on top of this linear growth, and x also oscillates on top of increase. So here you only can define the average velocity, which you measure in practice in experiments.
And what happens to that when k perp goes to zero?
Well, then all the description breaks down. So then you will have to go back and derive another description for a better parameterized form of the domain wall.
Well, that's a realistic regime as well, huh? Because it makes up actually a symmetric wire.
It is a realistic regime, but for some reason people right now always make strip-like wires. So. Maybe, you know, you just have to make to persuade the experimentalists to go to another regime, but So far, that's their, that's what they're interested in.
So, we are theoreticians, so we should not.
Yeah. I'll talk a little bit about the other types of the main bullets.
So is low and high drive here, that's, is that relative to K-perp somehow?
Yes, relative to K-perp. Okay. So the first thing I'm doing is I say, let's put constant current, constant external magnetic field, calculate the average velocity. So that is possible to do, and possible to write the exact formula. And now you have two parameters again, I and B. And in this plane, I would like to show different regimes. So first of all, there is this center band where the regime is low drive, and this formula at the bottom applies. And outside of the band, here and here, you have high drive. The dashed line separates the regions where the velocity is negative and positive. So here it goes along the magnetic field, here it goes against the magnetic field. Let's first, and so if you do an experiment at a constant current ramping up magnetic field, then you go along the line like that, and you check what happens. So let's first go along the line of B, keeping I equal to zero, and that's the middle curve here, I equal to zero, which was calculated again in the 70s. What it shows is that as you cross this point, you go from low drive to high drive, and at this point, the velocity stops growing, the average velocity goes down, and then it starts to grow, it has a minimum, starts to grow again, but much slower, so this slope is much smaller than the original slope here. This point is known as the Wolper breakdown point. Now let's put some current. If you put a positive current, you go to this curve. If you put a negative current, you go to that curve. So that curve is characterized by the fact that there is a region where the motion is reversed. And in order to have a region with reverse motion, you simply have to have this line, this horizontal line, crossing the dashed line here. Now, if you calculate this line, you see that this point is of the order IC. At this point is of the order alpha times IC. And alpha is usually 1.01. So you find that there is a possibility, if you combine current and B, to have interesting phenomena even at small currents, not necessarily at large. And it seems that this was observed, this reversal. So these are data from Stuart Parkin's group. Different symbols correspond to different values of current. This is magnetic field. And so the red curve here shows that you go down, you decrease magnetic field, your velocity goes down, then becomes zero. Zero is an artifact of their experiment. They cannot measure negative velocities. So you can barely imagine that it goes negative. Actually, they have one point here for this current, which is positive again. So what they measured is very consistent with this idea that even small current can reverse the motion if magnetic field is also applied. And the reason for that is that it is very easy to go from low drive to high drive by magnetic field, but very hard to go from low drive to high drive by current. So if you assist current by going to high drive, you immediately have a different regime and current manifests itself differently. The second part is validated by this experiment. They fabricated a wire, which was around. So this is a top view. You have a wire which is bent as part of the circle. And then you apply magnetic field again in plane, which points down. So this is a cartoon. And you arrange the main wall inside of this bent wire. Because field points down, it favors this domain and this domain, and the main wall would like to be here at the bottom. Then they applied electric field, an AC electric current, through the wire. And they wanted to see how the response of the wire, the resistance, depends on the frequency of the current. And they observed the resonance-like behavior. So the picture is the current pushes the wall back and forth, and then the wall has its own resonant frequency because this position of the wall is minimum of potential energy, so there is some kind of pendulum-like behavior, and there is a resonant frequency, and that's what you observe in this experiment. So, indeed, if you take the equations which I used, and you study this bottom, you think about the pinning potential, you study the bottom of the pinning potential, you find, yes, you can have small oscillations around it, you calculate the frequency of this oscillation, it compares well to their results, and that's basically what they did. Tatara and Korna are their series. So now what we want to do is to see are there any other interesting regimes of motion of the main wall in this pinning potential. So let me first show you some solutions of the equations for the position. And this, the first thing is I take the domain wall, I put it somewhere here, close to the bottom, and let it go. And that's the typical solution. So it goes down and then oscillates around zero and then depths. So this is the regime studied in the Nature paper. However, if you start a little bit further and there is a divided point D, then instead of going down to the minimum, the domain wall climbs up. And it climbs and climbs, and then it finally reaches a point where it performs small oscillations, so it's a dynamic state. But otherwise, it's stable. So if you start with a domain wall a little bit above this point, it will go down and end up doing the same oscillations near it. So there is a dynamic stable point, which is a different state of the domain wall. To understand, well, first let's see how the phase portrait of the system goes and where are these different regimes of the phase portrait. The system of ordinary differential equation is autonomous, so we can, if current is constant, and V is constant, and the pinning is constant, then we can draw a phase portrait. So these are the trajectories of Q and Psi, there are two regimes. The first regime is here, where you have oscillations above several equilibria. The vertical axis is Psi, so the Psi is periodic with 2 pi. These two just differ by 2 pi, everything is periodic in this direction. So if you're close to one of those equilibria, you start spiraling around. These are the oscillations studied in the Japanese paper. But if you study, if you go far away, there is a separating red line and an attractive blue line. So if you start anywhere here, you go along the line and approach the blue line, or if you start here, you go to the blue line again. So everywhere to the right of the red line, you have this type of motion, and everywhere to the left, you have the other type of motion. And this curve, this phase portrait also shows why you have this type of oscillations around some moving equilibrium. This is because you can be to the left of the red line, but you still can go here along this line, which only eventually reaches one of those points down there and starts to rotate around it. So when you start to rotate, that's where you go from this regime to the actual oscillation regime. There is a correspondence between what we found for the pinning potential and what we already knew for the constant magnetic field. The pinning potential, of course, can be viewed as an effective magnetic field, which is now distance dependent. And so these three points have analogs with the points where the constant current line crosses the zero velocity line. And you can convince yourself that this is an unstable point, this is a stable point, and at this point, it is stable, but from this picture with constant B, you cannot predict that there will be an oscillation around it. That's because B is actually changing. How would you study this new equilibrium? Well, one of the ways is to give it a large current pulse to get it out of the minimum, far away enough, and then let it go. So this is again just a solution of ODEs showing how it would happen. The properties of this state are interesting also because the characteristic frequencies and times are very different from what are the characteristic frequencies and times for the oscillating state. So if a parameter R shown here describes how steep is your pinning potential, and in practical terms of the paper by Japanese group, R was a very, it's already a n-dimensional number, and if they had a very small number, essentially R is a ratio of those of the steepness of the pinning potential to the steepness of the perpendicular anisotropy. So they had it to be 10 to the minus 4, because in their experiment the field which created the artificial pinning was just several oersteds compared to Tesla for the perpendicular anisotropy field. So R is a very small number. The frequency of oscillating which they studied is the frequency associated with the perpendicular anisotropy, which is simply the FMR frequency of those stripes, times square root of R. But if you look at the frequency of oscillations here, that's given to you by omega k times the very different factors. Now that depends on the current you have applied and all. The time of approaching this is now much larger than the time of approaching this equilibrium. So that also could be a very interesting signature. And the distance to the dynamic equilibrium is a function of the current. All these formulas are estimates which you can obtain if you simply say that in this regime, psi is growing, we're doing 2 pi rotations, so you can approximate sine of 2 psi on average to be 0. And this is a very simple approximation, but it works with the accuracy of 20% or something. So to this point, the summary is that there are interesting phenomena at small currents. You can reverse the velocity with small current, even though magnetic field wants to push it forward, and there is a dynamic state. And now we'll talk a little bit about more esoteric properties of the dynamic state, what can we do with it, and that there is an analogy with the Josephson effect. So before I go into analogy, I would like to remind you that if you have a Josephson contact and study its electrical properties, you pass electric current through it, you measure voltage on it, and then this circuit is, this device is described by the equivalent circuit where you have the capacitance and resistor and the Josephson junction, and the, in a simple case, the equation describing it are given here. So if you take these equations and make them dimensionless, that's what you get with the left panel, and that's what we had for our domain wall displacement on the right panel. So there is a certain similarity with sines floating around and other terms being linear. But can we find some other mathematical similarities, one might say, or maybe they are 40. And again, this, the literature has a lot of ideas by Luc Breger. Again, they are kind of qualitative, not quantitative, and the difference from what we are doing here, that he was assuming that you are in a very steep pinning potential. So he says, okay, position of the wall is pinned, what will change is only the angle of psi. We propose to observe the position of the wall, and we want to observe the analog of the phenomena in Josephson junctions, which is Shapiro steps. What are Shapiro steps in Josephson junction? Let's say you do a usual experiment, you pass a current over the source of Josephson junction and you measure the voltage on it. So while the junction, while the current is smaller than the critical, this is one, there is no voltage, it's a superconductor. Now as you cross the critical current, then what happens is you start to have periodic voltage, which has a DC component and an AC component. So this graph shows the DC component of the voltage or average voltage. And normally it simply grows with the current. And there is a formula for this. Now, What happens is if on top of DC current you also pass the AC current through the Josephson junction, and the AC current has a fixed frequency omega AC. So then people observe this type of BA characteristic. They have a step, and this is called Shapiro step. Why do you have Shapiro steps? So the physics behind it is that if you have a drive which with a fixed frequency, the system which wants to oscillate at certain frequencies itself, which are tunable by the DC current, when this frequency of oscillations forced oscillations under the DC current are roughly equal to omega AC, there is a phenomenon called mode locking. And so for a while, the system would normally like to change the oscillation frequency, but because of the AC drive, it doesn't. So here, the frequency is constant. And the window where you have this locking depends on the amplitude of I1. So when I1 goes to zero, there is nothing. So now, if you know that there is mode locking, then you can predict where, you can predict something about the value of voltage on the step. And that's how it's done. If you take the equation on the previous slide, you see that x is simply 1 over r by dot. So if you want to find what's the average x, or the average voltage in this case, you have to integrate. So this is just the definition of averaging. Since you know that phi is periodic, you can either integrate from 0 to infinity or integrate from 0 to a period and divide by a period. You will get the same result. And so therefore, the answer is 2 pi over rt, but t is a period of oscillation, which on the left panel would be a function of I naught of the DC component. So up to this point, you didn't gain anything. You simply rewrote the formula, and you have to work hard to calculate this period. However, if you know that there is locking, then the period is exactly 2 pi over omega ac. So then you can find that you can write the last equality, and you find that while the modes are locked, the average x has to remain constant. And the analog of that in the case of our equations is written here. So the average of the displacement x is going to be the average of the derivative of psi, but unlike in the Josephson case, we have an extra term here. So again, if you are in the locking situation, this guy is constant and independent of current, but this guy, I'm sorry for being sloppy, this d is the ratio of I over IC. But this guy does change with the current. So here is the result of the solution of the equations. The black dots is what you get without the AC drive, and then the pink dots is what you get with the AC drive. So you see this very nice step. Why do we have step? That's because it's really not a step. It's a line with a very, very small slope determined by beta. But beta is small, and therefore it's almost a step, or at least you will always see these two endpoints of the mode locking region. So I guess that's what you would observe in the main wall motion in the pinion potential. Lebrager was proposing Shapiro steps again in the case where the pinion potential is very sharp. So it's a different situation. And one slide about the real world pinion walls. The equations which I wrote, and the reason why I could solve them so easily is because they were treating the very simple domain wall. And the domain walls which are observed in the wires currently manufactured are so-called vortex domain walls. So the vortex domain walls, this is their picture of an experiment, that's how the theorist would describe them. They have this central complicated structure where you have kind of a vortex around the middle point, and then when they move, the position of the vortex actually also moves up or down the wire. And in principle, it's not clear that everything I talked about is applicable to the real world wires. However, what was important for all my calculations is that there are two variables. One is the displacement, and the other is the cyclic variable psi. Well, here there is an analog of the cyclic variable, which is the position of the vortex. The vortex starts in the middle, goes down, then it reaches the other side, but at this point it immediately is generated again and starts moving from the other side of the wall. So a lot of people qualitatively believe that in the wires where the wall of the vortex, you still have the cyclic variable, and in such a way you will get the same equations, but to prove it, that's what we are doing now. To really have a theory of that. So my conclusions are that there are observed things, there are things which may be observed person, and there are things for the future experiment.
You showed a picture of a vortex-like domain wall evolving into a transverse wall. Mm-hmm. I was just curious, it seems like the amount of time that would take would be very strongly dependent on the transverse size of the strip. Like here, it looks like it occurs quite rapidly, but I was just thinking on the basis of ordinary critical phenomena and so on. You think it would take a much longer time to unwind some topological defect?
Well, it's not when the vortex reaches the boundary. So it's not that you have to unwind it by some fluctuations, right? You can't have a way to take it out of the system by taking it to the boundary.
That's right. But most of the system is far from the boundary. It seems like there's at least a power law dependence on.
But again, it doesn't go to the boundary due to fluctuations. It goes there because the current or magnetic
field
wants to push it.
Sort of the whole vortex gets
moved
to the boundary.
Okay.
Is there an issue in, maybe people know from an experiment, you might imagine that when you have a domain wall and the domain wall moves, let's say, that it will can disturb the spin waves or something like that, create spin waves or launch spin waves or make...
There were experiments like that in the old days,
okay.
So people have the oldest theories to explain them. I think at this point in the nanowires, the experiments are, unfortunately, the results are very scattered, so different groups don't agree. And in order, I think, to discuss this issue of emitting waves, usually people discuss it in the sense that, okay, there is some kind of extra damping for domain wall which suddenly appears after a certain velocity or something. But if your measurements of velocity are so scattered, it's hard to really experimentally make a case that there is some kink or something in the velocity function of external drive.
But you can do that, of course, also from a purely theoretical point of view, because if we look at the simulations by Thierville, you get these nice movies where the domain wall is moving under a current in the system, and you see sometimes it sort of emits spin waves.
No, I agree that this is something which people will have to worry about, but I mean, my feeling is that right now there is not enough connection between theory and experiment but that's totally true. That's a very valid direction to work.
So do you have any clear opinion about the magnitude of beta, whether it's zero or whether it can be made large?
Well, the only thing I know is that if you take the results of the Japanese paper and you try to fit them, and then you get kind of a large beta.
That was what material?
Permalloy? No, that was permalloy.
Yeah.
But this is also what Stuart says, right? That you can fit his results with numerical simulations only with a large beta.
Well, the point is also that although qualitatively the equations for the transverse walls should probably work, but quantitatively they don't have to work. So For example, if you measure this kind of relationship, and then if you measure this slope and you measure this slope, the equations for a transverse fold give a prediction that the ray this time, this slope is alpha squared times the large slope. It has to be 10 to the 4 times smaller, roughly. In the experiment, it's maybe 15 times smaller, but not 10,000 times smaller. That could be very well because the wall is a vortex wall, not a transverse wall. So, so the fact that you do not have quantitative correspondence with the equation, you know, in other places, maybe just the same issue that you just have. You just have to develop right equations for the vortex walls. So, yes.
I'm not familiar with that, but if you want to derive some effective equation motion for the vortex domain, well, you have only to assume some shape of the function, which is not mm-hmm. like the Hepsilon function, but some additional.
Yeah.
And so starting from the Gilbert random damping equation, then you obtain some equation.
Yeah. So
it's a very simple lesson, right?
It's what?
It's very simple. Seems to be simple lesson.
What does it look like
when it really explains the experiment?
I don't know yet. So the point is that in order to write such kind of equations, you have to have some nice form, a form of magnetic field which is approximated by a function with a small number of parameters. So, for example, one parameter obviously is the position of the vortex, but maybe it's not the only parameter which shows you how the vortex wall is, what is the exact shape.
Thank you. So let's start. Okay. So first I would like to thank the organizers giving me the opportunity to give a talk here. And so what I can talk about is the measuring barrier curvature by angle resolve for the emissions in spin orbital coupled systems. The title is kind of misleading because I want to put more sexy to attract more people to listen to. Wow. It's not not exactly, but the physics is reflected in actually is a similar kind of physics, better coverage for the spin hole effect. So my name is Champion. So I'm not a lie. So the paper actually was published. This work was done together with Dumlai Form's group at Fudan University. He's an experiment, and he was a former ZX Chen's student. 2 years ago, he moved back to China, set up his lab. And now actually, 2 weeks ago, he went to Stanford to do the experiment. So I don't have the data yet. So we hope can locate that after a couple. So the work also with early work with with Andrew Bernovic and Kanjun, who is a postdoc here, RDP. Bernovic is a student. And if I have time, actually, I can also mention some numerical calculations which were done together with my student and a collaborator in the Institute of Physics of China this summer about the spin accumulation induced by the confined potential under the boundaries. Actually, that case also leading to some spin accumulation boundaries like spin hole effect. So when you measuring spin accumulation and say this is spin hole effect, and should be more careful to consider this effect also. So the outline, I will give a brief motivation, and so far the barrier phase in the momentum space in the spin orbital coupled system, and I will brief describe the angle resolved photo emission technique, and the effect I'm looking actually is a dark collision effect due to electric field observed in the angle resolved photo emission. And finally, if I'm trying to talk about spin accumulation by these confinement potentials. So spin orbital coupling is a relative effect and has been discussed in this workshop, I think, many times. So the interesting thing is like you consider solid state physics, then you have band structure. So far, in semiconductor, these three important spin orbital coupling terms. The first one is Rochebrune spin orbital coupling, which is due to the asymmetry of the confinement potential in the solid direction, and also the Jeusselhorst spin orbital coupling, which is due to the breaking the inversion symmetry in the material. And then the third one is in the valence band of the semiconductor. So actually, it's a bulk property. So you have a spin 3/2 system. And so these spin orbital coupling systems, when you look, when the spin orbital coupling is very, very strong, actually, we know it leads to band split